Welcome to the Successful Athletes Podcast presented by Trainer Road, where we interview successful athletes to make you a faster cyclist or triathlete. And this week, we have a special guest with us, 24-hour time trial world champion, Megan Hakkinen. How you doing, Megan?
Hi, I'm good. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, it's our pleasure. Thanks for joining us. This is going to be an episode where we dig into like really long racing. It's something that we don't talk a whole lot about with Trainer Road. In many cases with the Ask a Cycling Coach podcast, like when we're talking about multi-day events or 24-hour events, that sort of thing, we talk many times about the fact that, you know, the energy systems that you use for even long efforts like that, you can train them effectively with less time, sure. But this is going to be one where we dig into like the logistics behind executing one of those races. And it's going to be super interesting. And it's really cool to have the 24-hour time trial world champ here. So first of all, Megan, where are you from and how'd you get into cycling to kick us off?
For sure. So I grew up in Surrey, British Columbia, just south of Vancouver, close to the US border. I got into cycling when I was in my 20s and I needed to kind of find a way to break up my commute to university a bit. I also injured my knee, so my physio suggested it might be a good thing to do kind of for rehab, low impact. And just kind of grew from there. I started commuting regularly and really enjoying the freedom it gave me and an opportunity to kind of, do something new. And I got into cycle touring and I've done some big tours across Canada, the Pacific Coast and the Cascade Range into Mexico. And those were all like really wonderful adventures. And I learned a lot about traveling long distances.
Holy cow.
Yeah.
Those are huge. I mean, across the North American continent, that's huge.
Yeah. I guess I said that kind of casually.
Yeah.
It was 10 years ago. So it was a long time ago. But the mileage, the daily mileage is quite low. Like I think I averaged about 100 kilometers, 60 miles a day. So I wasn't pushing anything crazy, but you know, you're carrying all your touring gear. You're not aiming for speed. And you're, you know, getting to camping interesting places and meet people along the way and stopping at museums and sightseeing kind of opportunities. So, and then I guess I took a little bit of a break from touring. I started playing roller derby and got back into contact sports and blew up my knee again. And then I had surgery again. And then I got back into cycling a bit more. Again, because it's a bit safer than smacking people around on a flat track on roller skates. And and I thought it might be, you know, yeah, I already knew I liked cycling. So it was good to kind of transition back into that. So that's kind of where I started.
And then amongst all of those, so you did those tours early on and you mentioned that it was more like, you know, the experience of just going point to point and taking your time and everything else. But and that's kind of like the spirit of like randonnée in a lot of ways, right? In the sense that like a lot of, it's less about like who can get there first. And it's more about like the experience and doing all that. But at the same time, there's also ones that like make no bones about being races as well. Plenty of people do not race them competitively for the win, but some of them do. When did you start getting competitive with it?
So I started in randonneuring or randonnée or audits, I think they call it in the UK, yeah, in 2016. And I was going to grad school in Saskatoon, Saskatchewan, which sounds like a made-up place, but I assure you, it's real. It's kind of near the geographic center of Canada. And it's kind of like the Great Plains, Kansas or something. And I wanted a way to get out of the city. And I was, you know, I was studying really hard. I was working a lot on my master's thesis and I didn't have time to tour. I didn't have a lot of money. I was incurring a bunch of debt. And I heard about this club called the Prairie Randonneurs and they did these long rides. And at the time it seemed insane, you know, like they did a series of 200, 300, 400, 600 brevets. And I was like, it doesn't seem real. Like I expected to show up at one of the, you know, the start lines and just see all of these like superhumans in like, you know, superhero costumes all decked out and just like ready to, I don't know, crush the ground. But they were these really strong older folks. Most of them were retired and they had so much knowledge and wisdom to share with me. So that was kind of my introduction into covering distance a bit quicker. And they were fabulous mentors and taught me a lot about fueling on the road and staying hydrated. And when you ride in the prairies, there's big gaps between towns, like over 60, 80 miles. So you really have to be prepared to handle those stretches without refuel options. And carry enough water and, you know, just manage your fuel intake when you're in the middle of nowhere. And, you know, you show up at a gas station and it's closed early because it's family run and there's a sign on the door telling you to come back tomorrow. And you're like, man. So it was a great environment for learning. In 2016, when I was kind of getting into randonnée, Lael Wilcox won the Trans Am bike race. And the Trans Am is a coast-to-coast race across the U.S. It's one of the biggest self-supported ultra-cycling events in the world. And it just really caught my eye that there was a female winner for this, you know, big competitive race. And I was so, I guess, just drawn to that. Yeah, it kind of sparked my inspiration and the idea that maybe I could compete as well. And I was just getting into these longer rides, but I was feeling really strong and I thought it might be something to shoot for next year. So at that point, I didn't have a road bike. I was using a touring bike with, like, you know, mountain bike handlebars and nothing fancy. But I went out and bought a road bike that fall and kind of transitioned into more road cycling, I guess.
That's Trans Am is no joke. Lael Wilcox, by the way, no joke either. Incredible athlete. And if everybody should look up, there's a lot of videos and articles written about her races that she's done, and she's an inspiring figure. She's as hard as they come, like the stuff that she endures, but she's really inspiring figure, and you as well in this case. So you got inspired to do it, and then you did Trans Am, correct?
That's right, yeah.
Was that like your first one where you were like really like pushing hard for a result, or was that still, you had gotten used to that already?
So that was my first like bike race, I guess, you know, first bike race, 4,300 miles. No problem. Yeah,
no big deal. Mine was a 15-minute crit, but that's okay. Yeah.
I'm sure it was super intense. Yeah.
Only because yeah. I was bad. So sorry. Here,
yeah. So the randonneur club that I joined, they were not competitive at all. And people who really pushed and kind of left the group to get a faster time were shunned a little bit, actually. So I always stuck with the group and rode together because I didn't want to be looked at as like a cocky brat who walked in and thought she could ride faster than everyone else. So I didn't really push for speed. And at the same time, I was learning a lot. So I don't think I could have busted out and ridden to the finish line faster anyways if I tried. So. For the Trans Am, though, I knew I wanted to be competitive. And in those self-supported long-distance races like that, competition, like you're kind of competing either for a podium position or you're competing with the people around you, or you're competing to finish within a certain predetermined time period that you kind of decide because everyone's at different abilities. And for the Trans Am, 30 days is kind of the recognized cutoff for racing and touring. So if you finish in over 30 days, you're kind of considered touring, and that's fine. But I wanted to consider myself a racer. So I wanted to finish in less than 30 days. That's also the max time I could get off work. So I made a plan to try and finish in 25 days and went out there and yeah, tried to kill that.
And so, man, there's probably so many things you learned. I can only imagine riding across the entire United States. Are there main takeaways that stand out to you that you learned in going long day after day and also doing so competitively?
Aero bars are your friend. I think it's easy to get like nerve damage on your hands from being in the, you know, being in those limited positions. And once you start using the aero bars, you can take the pressure off your wrists and put them onto your forearms. And the more I use the aero bars, the more functional my hands were. But I definitely had some nerve damage at the end that took a while to heal. But I had never used aero bars prior to that race. Like I started a month or two before. So it was kind of a bit of a balancing act to get into them.
Wow.
Yeah.
The good old saying of not doing anything fresh or for the first time on race day. Sorry. Like, you know, but hey, might as well, right? Better yeah, that way definitely. Than otherwise.
And I learned a lot about, I guess, the calorie intake that an athlete needs when you're competing at that, you know, more intense level. And when I was touring, I would eat like a lot of food, but nothing like when you're pushing out like, you know, 170 mile days, day after day after day. It's just like this eating contest across America. And I have a pretty good stomach. So I was mostly fine. I can stop at a gas station and kind of you know, eat sandwiches and chocolate milk and chips and bags of candy. Like, I can't do the burritos. I can't do the pizza or anything. There's a limit. But I learned a lot about fueling off of gas station nutrition.
That's a whole part of it, right? Like, with a race like that, when you're just self-supported and going across the country, you kind of have to be prepared for that, because otherwise, I mean, you can't carry all the food on you. What were you carrying on your bike and on your person going through the race?
So I have a set of frame bags. So there's a little top tube bag, and then I keep, like, you know, my wallet and any like little bits and bobs and stuff in. I had a bigger frame bag that I kept my spare tubes and tools, kind of the heavier things. And then I had a long seat post pack that I put like my bivy, my sleeping bag, you know, my leg warmers, arm warmers. I only had one set of kit, one rain jacket, one pair of socks, one of everything that got washed in the shower every few days when I got a hotel room or whatever. I think that was it for my bags. And then for snacks, I just like stuffed them in my pockets and would like, you know, strap them to the aero bars with a bungee cord. And like, you know, you end up with ridiculous stuff, like a Subway sandwich, like, you know, strapped to the aero bars, and like a liter of chocolate milk, like in your back pocket. One of my favorite things is those Donette's donuts, because they come in a nice roll and you can pocket those really easily, and they're pretty good.
Yeah, I've crushed sleeves of those before at gas stations mid-ride when I'm in a bad place. the crumbly coconut crumb ones are always my favorite ones.
That's a good one, yeah.
Yeah. So how did it go in terms of the outcome of Trans Am, your first competitive long event like that?
It was an amazing experience. I cannot say I loved every minute of it, but it was memorable in so many different ways. Just traveling across the country that quickly and getting to see all of, you know, all of these places that I'd heard about but never been, you know, being chased by dogs in Kentucky and getting to, you know, see all the red rock and antelope in Wyoming and going through Yellowstone National Park. So it was amazing. And I finished in 24 days, 22 hours, and 1 minute.
Wow.
Just under my 25-day goal. So I was pretty pretty stoked about that. And I think it really motivated me those last few days, kind of knowing that I wanted to finish within a certain time period. That really kept me going. And I finished, I guess, 24th out of 131 people. I was the third female finisher. And I was the first Canadian finisher that year. So that was exciting to represent my home country.
Holy cow. Way to go. Were there moments at any point, other than the Achilles, obviously, were there other moments when you thought that you wouldn't reach your goal of 25?
There were a couple of like really windy days. You know, when you're kind of being blown almost off the bike and you're like, is this a good idea? Should I be continuing? Like, you know, if I get, you know, thrown into traffic, like it doesn't make sense to keep going. But also, if you stop, then you know you're not moving forward. So there was a couple windy days where I stopped early, and I worried about, you know, that takes a big chunk out of your day. If you cover 70 miles instead of, you know, 200 or whatever, like that's a big deficit, and you don't know if the weather's going to be even better the next day or if it's just going to get worse. So you always kind of wonder, did I make the right decision to stop early or to take a longer break and try and ride at night instead? So there is definitely a few times where I lost sight of that goal. And there were times where I was like, oh, I'll just be happy to finish. Like, I'll be happy to book a ticket and get back home. Get me out of this place. So I can't say that I thought I would meet my goal the whole time. But it was good to have in the background. And I think that, I'm really happy with how things turned out in the end.
To 24-hour world champs, when was your first 24-hour world champs and what made you pursue that one? I mean, you placed really well at Trans Am, but what made you think that that was something, what motivated you to try it, I guess, is the question.
Yeah, so I did Trans Am in 2017 and I did the first world champs in 2018. One of my goals after finishing Trans Am was to see how fast I could do the 600-kilometer brevet. And the cutoff for that is 40 hours. And so I thought I could do it in less than 40 hours. So I went out that summer and I did it in like 27 hours, I think. And I felt pretty good about that. It was flat on the prairies. You know, I, I rode through a drive through at like midnight, and they gave me all these muffins, and they were like, "You go, girl. You keep going." Thanks.
That's awesome.
So yeah, it was a really great experience, and I think I kind of impressed myself that I could cover 600 kilometers in 27 hours. And I thought it was maybe a good window for me to compete in, because most people don't want to race 24 hours. It's a long time.
For sure. Yeah. It's hard.
But it is. Yeah. But it's a short time compared to something like the Trans Am, you know? I thought that I could maybe really push myself in that 24 hour period in a way that I wasn't able to do on a cross continental bike race. And I thought it might be exciting to kind of see what was possible, and that it potentially might do really well in it. And there's something kind of like beautiful about a 24-hour interval, like seeing sunrise and sunset and seeing everything transition, and it's the course of the day. My mom was like, "Why don't you just do a 12-hour race or a 6-hour race?" And I was like, "That's only part of the day. You don't get it, Mom. You just don't get it."
So where does the 24-hour world championships happen? Because I think it's a recurring location, correct?
That's right, yeah. So it happens in Borrego Springs, California, and it's organized by the same folks who put on the Race Across America, the supported bike race from Oceanside, California to Annapolis, Maryland. And yeah, it happens every year in the fall, and they do it in the fall because it's so hot there in the desert. So the temperatures in the day are a little more manageable, and the temperatures at night are, they're still pretty warm because it's in Southern California. So,
But still, I imagine there's opportunity for it to get cold still, cause you're out in the desert there. And yeah. So what's the course profile like? Is it mountainous? Because in that region, it's not far off of like Palm Springs and that zone down there. And as a result, like, you know, Palm Springs has really hard climbs, but it also has pan flat areas. So what's this course like?
Yeah, it's like one of those flat areas. And you get to look up at the mountains and be thankful that you're riding loops in the flat kind of desert with all the cactuses around you instead. It's an 18-mile loop with 350 feet of elevation gain. And most of that's on kind of one hill with about a 2% grade. So by the end of like the 24-hour period, that 2% feel like 20%. It just is absolutely brutal.
I bet.
But in the beginning, it feels almost flat. and the race is formatted. So after about 22, 23 hours, they start sending people onto a finishing loop. And that one's only 4.8 miles with about 60 feet of elevation gain. And it's really quick. It's really fun. It's a nice way to kind of end things because you're just kind of ripping around the short course and you're seeing everyone at the finish line and everyone's cheering for everyone. And it's just a really exciting way to kind of wrap things up after such a long period on the bike.
Oh, I'm sure. Yeah. 20. Yeah. I rode 24 hours before only once, and it was so hard. Well, we started in the afternoon, so then we wouldn't finish at nighttime because we figured that we would feel probably terrible by the time we got to the end. So we didn't want to feel terrible and have it be at nighttime. What time does this race start?
It starts at like 5 or 6 PM, depending on daylight savings. So you get one lap of, kind of full light, and then you get one lap of like dwindling light, and then it's nighttime. So it's kind of set up like the ride that you did actually, in that you're starting with daylight and then night comes, and then, you know, in the morning the sunlight kind of peps you up and everything. And I think it's a nice race format because you're starting when it's not too hot, because the heat really takes it out of you. So you kind of miss the hottest part of the day, and then you go into the evening, and then the temperatures can get really cold in the desert. Yeah. But you know that morning is going to come, sunrise will come and save you from this like mess that you've become overnight. and then you're just counting down the hours to the finish, you know, once noon hits. So
how was your finish that first time you did it?
So I finished, way quicker than I anticipated. I wasn't doing it to like win the event or anything. I was doing it to find out what I could do in a 24-hour period. And I, you know, didn't upgrade my bike or anything. I bought road shoes before I had mountain bike cleats. So I bought a pair of like road cleats and pedals, and I think that made a big difference. And I just wanted to see what was possible. And I did that. So my goal was to do 400 miles because that's how far you need to do to become RAM qualified. And I'm not really like planning on doing RAM anytime soon, but I thought being qualified, it's kind of like a badge of honor, you know, to be like, I'm RAM qualified. I could do this if I wanted to.
For sure.
So I wanted to be RAM qualified. So that was my target, 400 miles. And I did 456 and actually broke the course record by like 34 miles. But another woman broke the course record and did it a little bit faster than me. So I placed second in the women's division.
So close. Wow. But second place your first time. And I cannot, 456 miles. That's so far. Like
it's a long way. Yeah.
Yeah. I'm just thinking for anybody in like the Mountain West, I know that this is very much local to me, but I'm just thinking it's like Reno to Salt Lake City, even more than that. And doing that like in a day, that's amazing.
Thank you.
So with all of that, what did you learn your first time doing 24-hour world champs? Like the durations are getting like, you know, like the duration dropped so much from what you had done before. I assume the intensity was higher
and
probably didn't make many gas station stops.
No. So my longest training ride was 16 hours. So I had a pretty good idea of how I can handle time at intensity, but I think that I went out harder at the 24 hours, at the 24 hour race. And as you work harder and it just becomes harder and harder to digest your food properly. So I struggled with my nutrition a bit. And during the Trans Am, I just ate everything. I was this human garburator. And so I was planning my food and I wanted to have like croissants with like eggs on it and like mayo and like chocolate bars. And I'm trying to think, I had some ridiculous things I planned on eating. And my coach was like, are you sure those are good choices for this event? And I was like, I can do anything. I'm like the champion of the food. And he was like, okay, well, maybe have some gels on hand, like just in case you start getting into trouble.
Right, yeah.
And I didn't eat a single croissant. Like I carried one around in my pocket for like hours, and then I got to the kind of support stop and I like threw it on the ground at my support, who were my parents, and I was like, I can't eat this thing. Give me a banana. So I misplanned my food hugely. But the one thing I did do really well was pacing, and I was pacing mostly on like RPE. I kind of had ridden the course twice before, so I had an idea of what it felt like. I knew where the corners were, and I knew kind of where the tailwinds would be and where the hill was. So I paced myself really well. And when you look at my my lap paces, they're all exactly the same. Like I
wow,
it's an 18-mile loop, and I think my pace averaged between like 54 minutes and 58 minutes for the entire period. There was very little change. So that's, I think, what enabled me to do so well, because it's easy to go out really quick and then, you know, you're penalized for it later if you don't have the energy to keep that up. I learned a lot about working with a crew. I got my parents to crew for me because they were, they're snowbirds and they're down in Palm Springs. And I kind of told them about the event, and my dad was super keen. My mom was like, this sounds crazy. Like, I don't know if I want to be part of this. And, I actually got to Borrego and she saw all the excitement, and then it was an international event. She was totally on board, and they were amazing. They worked probably as hard as I did, like keeping me, you know, well taken care of, and just, you know, fed and hydrated and spraying me down with sunscreen and putting ice socks down my back and doing all of those little things that kind of keep the rider happy and keeping good pace up.
Did you, on this first one, you mentioned on the nutrition side that you couldn't eat those things. What did you eat?
My mom's vegan. So she suggested things like potatoes, yams, bananas, dates. Those are all things that went over really well, actually. I did really well. She like went and stole some watermelon and grapes from some of the other crews and fed them to me. And that went really well too. She would just like put a chunk of watermelon in my jersey pocket and I would eat me. it was pretty gross, but and then I was, I think I was using Gatorade for my hydration, which I know there's a lot of better things out there, but I drank a lot of Gatorade because it was so hot. I don't know the temperature in Fahrenheit, but it was like 37 degrees Celsius. It was pretty warm.
Wow.
Yeah. So it's difficult to stay hydrated. So I was drinking a lot of Gatorade. And what else was I going? Yeah, I ate all my gels. But I think I suffered the most kind of late at night. And by the end of the race, I'd kind of gotten over that. And I was feeling all right again. So I think if the race had continued on for another 6 hours, I would have been in trouble because I wasn't eating quite enough. But I managed to get through it and not bonk or anything.
So do you know, I mean, you weren't racing with power then. You've only recently actually got a power meter this year, which we'll talk about later on. But do you know roughly like around what sort of percentage of threshold or power do you think you were riding at for that sort of effort? Or even like an RPE level?
Yeah. Like 1 to 10. It's so hard to say because in the beginning it feels so easy. And in the end, it's just like, it's destroying you. Maybe like 70-ish% or 60, like 60 mm-hmm. to 70. I don't think it could have been higher than that really. And I don't think it was lower than 60. So we'll say 65 to 75.
So the interesting thing about that intensity of like 0.6 to 0.7 is the fact that it's more or less like what you can hold for a few hours. And then also it's interesting how that extends out. That's actually like something that is recently on the Trainer Road blog from one of our writers, from Jesse. He wrote an article on how to build a pacing plan for a race. And we broke it down on basically like 0.6 to 0.7, what you can maintain, 0.7 to 0.8, how long you can maintain that sort of thing. And sure, there's like individual variants, but it's just cool because I think a lot of people would think that 24 hours, that means that, you know, you go out at 0.4 IF and you just cruise the whole time, but it's not. And surely at the end, yeah, it feels a lot harder. So with that first race done, you came so close, and we'll get into more details. Don't worry on this for those that are listening, but you came so close, you went back to do it again last year, right? In 2019.
That's right. Yeah. I had to go back. As soon as I finished, that's kind of the first thing that came to mind is I can't wait to do this again. Which is a ridiculous thing to say after a 24-hour race, but I actually enjoyed it for the most part. You know, it was challenging, but it wasn't painful. And I think I really enjoyed the experience. It's a beautiful location. And it was just, yeah, it was a lot of fun for the most part with some rough stuff thrown in.
Yeah. It's so when you came back, your goal was to win, I assume, since you got second that first time.
Yeah, I decided that that's what motivated me, I guess, was coming in second so close. And I did have a great race. I had a lot of fun. I learned a lot. And I wasn't putting pressure on myself to, you know, to try and break any records or anything like that. And I did. So it was really a surprising way to complete the race. But I thought that maybe with some more specific training and, you know, with the whole year to kind of make some bike upgrades, I could perhaps win the next time around.
Mm-hmm. So what did you do differently about like, you know, and we'll go through everything in terms of nutrition. Okay. And then did you train more or less, or did you train differently throughout that time as well? Let's start with the training actually. First things first. Did sure. you change the way you trained that year?
So I've been super lucky in that in 2018 and 2019, I had an opportunity to go to Europe to travel and ride my bike. So in 2018, I think I did about 10,000 kilometers and I rode from North Cape in Norway to Tarifa in Spain and like kind of toured and did a lot of riding in Switzerland and Germany and some 600 brevets and stuff. So I had a really great summer. And then I came back, this is in 2018, I came back to San Diego and I trained there for 8 weeks before the time trial because I figured like, well, you know, I don't have a job right now. When am I going to set aside 8 weeks to compete in an event? So I stayed with some friends in Torrey Pines, kind of north of San Diego, and just treated myself like an athlete and did a lot of training, ate really well. I was going to Aquafit classes for the first time in my life, which are super fun.
Can you explain what that is for people that might not know?
Yeah, so it's kind of in a pool and they play music and you get to do all these fun dance moves. I'd say it's popular amongst like maybe an older demographic, but anyone can participate and it's amazing. Like it's just a really fun way to move your body. And I always left feeling really happy and stoked. Like it just, it's a great environment. So I totally recommend it to anyone who's looking for something else to do.
Awesome.
And I stretched a lot. Yeah. So I kind of had this 8-week training block before the race and then I came back home and got a job and returned to being an adult. In 2019, I went to Europe to compete in the North Cape 4000, which is a self-supported race. And from Italy to North Cape, so I returned to North Cape. And then after that, I did some training rides, and then I came back home in the end of September. And the race takes place in October and November. This year, I think it took place in November. So I had maybe 6 weeks to kind of dedicate to training for the 2019 24-hour time trials, but it was working. So my training was a bit different in that I had to manage training with my job, and I work 3 12-hour shifts a week. So I do actually have a lot of time to train. I've kind of 4 days off. So I was able to put in some longer training blocks, but I did focus more on training in shorter periods and doing intervals. I wasn't using trainer road at the time, but I also knew that like I couldn't put in the long days that I was doing when I was in San Diego. And I also didn't want to because the weather isn't so great here in October. So it's not, it's not this joy of riding past all these gorgeous beaches and looking at all these super fit athletes running around and, leaping into the Pacific. Like all of that, wasn't happening in the Okanagan in October. It was quite cold. So I tried to minimize my outdoor training, actually. The cold air is a little bit hard on my lungs. So I ended up doing some of my 6 and 8 hour rides indoors, which was like super boring, we'll say.
Pretty hard.
I don't
want
to go into it.
Yeah.
It was boring and sweaty and hard and just not a lot of fun, but necessary. So
yeah, the goal matters more, right?
Definitely. Yeah. And, I feel like I'm glad that I have an indoor trainer and I'm able to train indoors and kind of have that option about where I want to be.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So when you came into, on equipment, did you change anything equipment wise where you were like, oh, I learned this time, it was not the thing I wanted to use. Now this year I'm going to use it.
Yeah. So I bought a time trial bike. So that was something I thought might be important for a time trial.
Right.
I got a Cervelo, I think it's a P3. And I literally bought it because I read somewhere that half the people at Kona have Cervelos. And I was like, cool, it's probably good enough for me. And I found a used one and the guy seemed pretty cool. And he was flying out to Whistler for a ski vacation. So I met him at the airport and we traded the bike for cash. And yeah, it's been awesome. I love it. I always send him emails whenever I do something fun on it. And I'm like, this is me and your old bike. And he's like, good job, keep it up.
That's cool.
And then I used a pair of Zip 808s that I had borrowed from a friend for the race. And aero wheels, they make a difference.
Yeah, they really do. And the sound, at least, just the sound, right? It sounds so cool.
Yeah, it's very cool. Yeah, I feel kind of like I'm about to lift off and blast into space because I'm going so fast. And,
yeah.
And then I changed my water bottle setup a bit because I wanted to keep everything really aero. So I got kind of the water bottles that sit behind you on the seat post. And it is so hot. So I wanted to be able to carry a lot of water. So I had the two behind me and then the one kind of in the aero bars with the straw. And I ended up not really using the ones behind me. Like in training, I was using them, but actually in the race, like the act of reaching your arm behind your back from that aero position after 10 hours, you just don't want to do it. So I just wasn't using them. So I don't think I'll use those going forward, but they seemed like a good idea. What other equipment upgrades did I do? I think those were like the big ones, the TT bike and using the wheels. And, I'll have to invest in some wheels of my own, but it was great to have friends to lend you stuff, right? So
absolutely. What about what you were wearing, your kit? What sort of helmet did you have? What sort of kit did you have, that sort of thing?
So I upgraded my helmet. I forget what it's called. I think it's a Viper, but maybe that's just the color. It's bright red. It's an aero helmet and it's red.
We'll get a picture so then we can see it, and we'll have this in the forum post for this episode so people can see.
Sure. Yeah. No, it was a red arrow helmet, and I liked it, and it felt nice. You know, it was quite breathable and stuff. It wasn't one of those like ones with the crazy tails or anything like that. Mm-hmm. And I think my shorts were like sportful. I have a hard time finding shorts in the city I live in. Doesn't have many bike shops, and when they do have women's clothing, there's like one or two things to try on, and I'm not going to buy shorts without trying them on. So these are one of the few ones that I found that I liked, and I ordered like four more pairs, because like once you find something you like, you should just buy a lot of it, especially if it's Lycra and it will disintegrate in like a year. So, and I think I wore like a Rafa Souplesse like Aero jersey that was fashionable and fit really comfortably. So super Aero. And I wore compression socks, which is something I had never really used before, but I had some like foot swelling the first time I was at the 24-hour race, and it wasn't terrible, but like it wasn't comfortable at the end. Like I had to loosen my boas right off to like the, you know, their loosest setting, and it just didn't feel great. The compression socks were great. They were nice at night when the temperature was cooler, and I didn't have any of those swelling issues. So I would definitely use them again for ultra events like that. They're not stylish, but they're very practical.
Yeah, they're effective. What did you bring for the cold time at night in terms of what you wore on your body?
So I brought like a whole bunch of layers so that I could choose what I wanted to use. I had like a rain jacket and a couple different vests. I ended up wearing like a reflective vest that was pretty thin but windproof, and arm warmers. And I put on full-fingered gloves for maybe like 4 or 5 hours or something. And then I wore leg warmers and toe covers. Yeah, I wore toe covers. So the temperatures got down to like freezing. It was kind of in one of those marshy areas, and it was surprisingly cold. And when you're descending on the hill, it got really cold as well. And so a lot of people kind of penalized themselves because they didn't bring enough clothing, and they had to take these breaks to warm up, which is exactly what you don't want to do, is stop, right? And it gets to a point where, you know, you can't feel your fingers or your toes, and you're just, you know, maybe putting yourself in too much risk. It's probably the right decision, but it's not a decision you should have to make if you plan correctly. So, yeah.
What was the heat like during the day?
It was hot, but not unmanageable, I would say. Like I used ice socks to kind of stay cool. I think the first year it was so hot. The second year felt like fine in comparison. Yeah, so it was hot, but it wasn't deadly. I think being able to have ice in my water bottles at all times and keeping those ice socks like on your back was just like a lifesaver. It was really nice to kind of have that cool melting sensation going on from like 10 a.m. onwards.
Yeah, to give people like a point of reference, when you're talking about like 37 degrees Celsius, that's, you know, that's almost 100 degrees. It's like 98 degrees in Fahrenheit for the year before. So this is a zone, like an area where you can get 100 degrees, and then it can still get down close to freezing even overnight. So really like huge temperature swings. Did you learn anything on the crewing side? Did your parents still crew for you, and did you change anything in that regard?
Yeah, so I somehow convinced my parents to crew for me again. And we all had more experience June. My parents, myself, and my sister were all part of a crew for a Race Across America team, and it was four women from the UK called the Golden Girls. they were all in their late 60s or early 70s, and they were trying to be the oldest all-female team to finish the Race Across America. So my coach is their crew chief, and he kind of brought my family on board so that they would learn more about crewing, and if they, you know, I decided to do Race Across America or other events, they would know more about it. And it was a huge learning curve, like, you know, chasing this group of women across the country in an RV and trying to manage people's appetites and hydration and nutrition and moods, and just that many people in an RV and follow vehicles. It's a crazy experience. But we all learned a lot. And so when my parents went down to Borrego again to crew for me, they knew a lot. And I think that I was better able to communicate like what I wanted and how kind of I wanted the the bottle handoffs and stuff to be. So it was much more efficient. And my parents knew what kind of questions to ask me, you know. We had like things like my layering strategy all kind of laid out. They knew exactly, you know, what my options were and what I might want to put on. And we had a really good system for communication, which was super important. So I had my phone stuffed in my pocket, like hooked up to a, you know, a battery pack or whatever. And my phone was on auto answer. So anyone who called me, my phone would just auto answer so I could talk to them. And they called me once a lap to see what was going on. Yeah. Yeah. So it was pretty funny. I had some friends call me, like, you know, and not expect me to pick up. And I was like, well, I don't have a choice. Like I can talk for like 2 minutes. That's it.
That's cool. That's a good idea to think of too, for, you know, because I'm sure that was motivating for you and it really helped logistically, I'm sure, because then your parents could prepare and have everything ready for that next stop.
Definitely. Yeah. So they would call me every single lap and I could say, what I needed, what I, you know, if I wanted to make a full stop or if I just wanted a bottle passed off or if I didn't need to stop for anything at all. And we recruited two more crew members. One was someone who was on the crew for the Golden Girls. He was from Portland and, he volunteered to crew for me again. And another was a friend in LA who offered to drive out. So, I had a 4-person crew instead of a 2-person crew, which just made all the stops much, much quicker because it's kind of like all hands on deck. Like someone's switching over my light and someone else is switching over my bottle and someone's kind of doing like a verbal check-in with me to make sure I'm doing okay still, like emotionally and everything. And, you know, and someone else is checking my tires and making sure that I don't have like a piece of glass in them or something. So to have that much care and attention on me as a rider was something I never experienced before. And it was actually like a really beautiful feeling. Like I felt so like loved and taken care of. And I couldn't believe that I had 4 people all attending to my well-being. Like, yeah, it felt amazing. I just feel so blessed.
That's awesome. With this race, did you change the way you paced at all?
From
having raced it before?
Yeah. So before I was doing it mostly on RPE, and this year or that year, I guess I had started using a heart rate monitor as well. So I was kind of trying to figure out in my longer training rides what kind of heart rate I could sustain for a long period. My longest training ride is probably like 9 hours, but I managed a heart rate of about 140. So I figured I would try and keep my heart rate at 140 and see how that went for me. And I, you know, did that for a lap or two the day before. And I was like, yeah, this should put me at a pretty good pace. You know, I feel pretty good about this. And then when the actual race happened, I went out like way harder than that and I just couldn't reel it in. And when, my crew was like, go, Megan, go. And my mom was like, don't tell her to go. Tell her to slow down. She's going too hard. And she was like outvoted by the other 3 people being like, no, she's doing great. We're going to tell her to keep going.
Oh, no.
I know. So I really suffered and paid for that. I paced myself much better that first year, actually. I had a great few laps and then in the middle of the night, I was like, I'm dying. I can't keep doing this. I have failed everyone. It was a really dark place. And then I kind of held it together and accepted a slower pace and pulled through in the end.
What else helped you get through that moment? Feeling like you had prepared for so long, you had this goal, you had people counting on you. All of that stuff that was on your shoulders. What else did you do to get through that or to manage it?
I think trying to think of each lap as its own individual unit and trying not to think too far ahead. So, you know, if you're like 6 hours into a 24-hour race, that's kind of a discouraging place to be. But if you're halfway through a lap, you know, that's a pretty good place to be. You only have to do 9 more miles or whatever. And some of them are going to be downhill. So I think kind of thinking lap by lap or even turn by turn, you know, and kind of looking for those markers, and you don't really see very much at night, but there's a few telephone poles I got really familiar with seeing. And I listened to music like almost the entire time. I just had my Spotify like playlist on shuffle and they're all kind of my, you know, my fave songs that I can listen to anytime, million times over. Lots of like terrible 90s dance music, like Ace of Base and stuff like that.
Heck yeah.
Yes. So I think having the music going was really good. And I think it kind of enabled me to to zone out a little bit, not zone out. It enabled me to get away from like my own thoughts when they were turning kind of toxic and just enjoy being there a bit more. And so then I would go back to like listening to my music and then monitoring my numbers and, you know, and just constantly being like, okay, Megan, are you in a good aero position? Are you breathing correctly? Is your pedal stroke, you know, good? Or are you doing something weird with your knee? So, focusing on actually riding the bike instead of like, the future, was something that really helped me kind of get through the tough part at night. And I knew when sunrise happened that, things were going to get a little bit better, just being able to see more. I think I'm a little afraid of the night still, and my mind does weird things and goes weird places.
So. Oh yeah. Yeah. Same here. Yeah, absolutely. Things start talking on the side of the road to me still. Yeah. And then especially when you're in that, cause racing puts you in this fight or flight mode anyway. So then you have that, and then you have everything else that combines with it, and it's really tough. And there's, especially when you're going for a goal, I feel like there's probably, you know, there's a lot of fear involved, right? In the sense, like fear of coming up short on your goal, or, and then since it's racing, it's dangerous. There's tons of other stuff too. How do you manage that? Is it the same thing of just focusing on the task at hand and just doing that? Or have you found a way to get better at that over time?
I think, yeah, focusing on the task at hand and trying to maybe look at things externally. If you can, and recognize like what's a real risk and what isn't worth thinking about. Like I was paranoid I was going to get a flat because every once in a while I would see someone pulled over with a flat and I was like, oh man, that would suck. Like I really don't want a flat. And they sweep the roads and clean them up before the event, but you know, it still happens. And maybe those people went into the race with like a piece of glass in their, you know, their tire, and that's why they flatted. Like who knows? But I just knew it, I didn't want that to happen to me, and I would get paranoid and start thinking about it, and then I have to kind of step out and be like, Megan, this is not something that you should spend your time thinking about. You're worrying about something that may or may not happen that you have no control over. Like, you know, avoid the potholes. There's no broken glass or anything obvious, and see, yeah, and just don't think about this. It's just this little demon that's nagging in your mind. So I think sometimes trying to kind of, you know, talk to yourself, talk yourself out of some of those unuseful mind trips can be useful. That was kind of a weird circular sentence. But
yeah, exactly.
But trying to be rational, I think, in times of, that are trying is important, and not letting yourself get like carried down that road, because you can go really far down that road and it's not a good place.
Yeah, that's a great way to put it. Maintaining rationality amidst all the chaos. So that year I'll let you say it. How did it end up going?
Yeah. That year I won. So I am the 2019 women's 24 hour world time trial champion. And I managed to do, thank you, a few more miles. So I did 460.8, I think. So I improved my previous year by 4.8, which doesn't sound like a lot, but I think that maybe the weather conditions were a little harder. It was really cold at night, and I don't do well in the cold. And I like to tell myself it was a harder race this year. It may or may not have been.
Way to go. That's amazing. A time trial world championship. What did it feel like? Because your beginnings in the sport, it wasn't like you were a child and you're like, I want to be an Olympian, and you like, you know, chase that dream your whole life, and then you achieved it. You approached it, you know, cycling itself from like a casual perspective for so long. What did it feel like to become a world champion?
That's a good question. I felt a little surreal because it was something that I had in mind when I started planning for the race, but I started to get intimidated by the competition. So I kind of pushed the thought from my mind because it was stressing me out. You know, I felt like I had made this commitment to myself and now I might not be able to do it. And then training wasn't fun anymore. And then I was like, oh, Megan, just focus on you. Just focus on you. So by the time the race actually came around, I wasn't really in it to win it anymore. I just wanted to compete and hopefully better my time. So winning was like even better because I didn't really enter with that intent. It felt like all of my training over the last few years and kind of all these small steps had built up into something kind of really amazing and special. And just seeing the support that I'd received from, you know, my parents who were caring for me, my friends who were there caring for me, and the other people who had met in the ultra distance cycling community who kind of just given me tips and information and like kind of eased me into this like slightly ridiculous sport. All of those thoughts were kind of running through my head, and that I didn't get there from, you know, doing one 24-hour stint in the desert. It was, you know, a few years of kind of progressively training smarter and harder and being able to kind of learn how my body reacts to things, how my, you know, body takes in nutrition and reacts to training and how much recovery I need, and all of those things kind of go into it. Yeah.
How cool. What an achievement. This has been awesome. I feel like if you could give some advice to somebody in terms of race day execution, like things that you feel like are really important things that you would give advice to somebody that's planning on doing a long event, whether it's 24 hours or whether it's 12 hours, something like that, something that's going to push them. Are there any like a few key tips that you would give them?
For sure. Yeah. Have a plan. I think that's the most important thing, is creating a plan based on your abilities, not what you want your fitness level to be, what your fitness level actually is, like based on real data and real numbers. You're not going to like show up on race day and be a unicorn. Like, you know, you are what you are, make your plan off of that. And also have fun. I perform better when I'm happier and I'm having a good time. And I know that. So when I'm having fun, I do better. And I think that's probably true for a lot of people, especially with ultra events where it's like, you know, it's not about executing on like the top end of your FTP. It's about sustaining a lower pace. And I think a lot of it's in your head. And if you're, you know, if you feel like it's really hard, then your power is going to drop because it just feels so difficult and you're just getting bogged down and everything. But you're kind of enjoying yourself and you don't realize, you know, that you're actually working pretty hard. Time goes by faster. And then, before you know it, you're at the finish drinking beer with your buddies. So
that's awesome. What's next for you then? Cause you've got, so now, which is, it's exciting to see, and I'm excited to see like how things go for you, because now you're using Trainer Road. And actually, we should probably cover that, how you're using Trainer Road in conjunction with your training, because once again, training for this really long stuff, what training plan are you doing, and how do you arrive at that, and how are you mixing it in with the other training you're doing?
Yeah, for sure. So I started using Trainer Road at the beginning of the pandemic because I needed something to ground me and keep me on task and kind of, yeah, I needed some training goals because I realized all my other events were canceled. I figured it was a great time to start training with power. So I got a Stages power meter. I started training with Trainer Road. I got the power meter for my road bike. So that's the bike I'm, you know, riding around outside on. And indoors, I actually use virtual power. And I don't care that that's not my real power. I use it on my time trial bike. And I think eventually I get a power meter for that. But for training purposes, it's fine.
It's equally as effective. Yep.
Yeah. And it's great to be able to leave a dedicated bike on my indoor trainer, so I'm not like swapping them around. And I don't love riding my time trial bike on the road just because it's kind of a, you know, an aggressively aero position. It's, you gotta be more careful and stuff. So, so it's enabling me to kind of keep my, you know, my aero position and everything dialed in. I tend to go big or go home. So I went into the, the like sweet spot base, high volume two. You know, I couldn't go to the gym anymore. So I threw it all into cycling. and it went really well. Like I felt like, because it's based off my FTP, I feel like, you know, a little fear when I look at some of the workouts, but I'm like, no, Megan, this is all tailored to you. Like you should be able to execute. And so far that's been the case. And it's funny because, like, you know, I listen to the podcast, so I hear Chad talking all the time, and I know that he does the workout text. And at first I was like, oh, Chad, hate you. I can't believe, like, gosh. And he'd say things like, you're halfway to halfway there. And I'm like, halfway to halfway there? That's like nothing. Like, oh, just shut up. I'm not even going to read you anymore. Anyways. Then, like, I had this, like, 180 after, like, I can't remember. It was a pretty hard sweet spot workout. And the text helped me get through it. And now when I read halfway to halfway there, I feel encouragement. I'm like, halfway to halfway there. Before you know it, you'll be halfway to there. And then you'll be three quarters of the way there. So I've totally changed how I view that statement.
That's awesome.
So I finished a sweet spot base, I guess, 1 and 2. So I've done it, I guess, 12 weeks. Mm-hmm. I've had an FTP bump of 12, which is pretty nice. One a week.
Way to go. Yeah, that's awesome.
Yeah. I'm pretty stoked. I'm not quite like Amber Pierce, but I think we're coming from different backgrounds.
Yeah, Amber's next level. It's impressive. Yeah. And for those that are listening and don't know Amber Pierce, she works here at Trainer Road. She's also a retired pro cyclist, pro road cyclist in the women's pro peloton. Raced over in Europe and everything else at the world's largest stage in terms of road cycling, you know, high performance road cycling, right? So she's an incredible athlete. Not to mention she was also like a collegiate swimmer and tons of other stuff. So yeah, super impressive. How are you mixing that in then with your other training? Are you just are you doing it? I mean, now we're in the middle of summertime. You live in Kelowna, BC, which is a beautiful place, and everything mm-hmm. else. How are you mixing it in?
So I do some workouts outdoors, and the days I work, I do indoor training because it makes a lot more sense, you know, from training like, you know, 8 to 10 p.m. or something like that. But I try and get outdoors when the weather is good, and I use the outdoor workouts. And especially like an endurance workout, it's really, you know, it's really easy to do that outside and get all those joys of, you know, cycling on the road, seeing different things in different places and kind of tick off the workout. I do one long ride a week to kind of make sure I have my endurance base up. So that's usually between 6 and I guess my longest was 19 hours. Some weeks I have like really high training hours and I look at it, I'm like, all right, I did like a 10 hour and a 4 hour ride. That's why it's so high.
Wow. Holy cow.
But I think going for those long rides and not having any structure is kind of what I need to remember why I like riding bikes in the first place. And I actually really love training. I think it's been great to focus my attention on that aspect and I enjoy it, but sometimes I wonder like what the purpose is. Like I feel like I'm just riding my bike like a little hamster on the wheel, and being able to put my fitness to the test outside and travel through landscapes at a good pace and, you know, get to enjoy the climbs and the descents because my fitness is there. It just feels really good. And it's a reminder of like what cycling is. And and I'm one of those people who enjoys stuff more when I'm better at it. So if I can do something faster and, you know, feel better at the end of the day than just like completely burned out because I'm not as strong as I could be, you know, I'll enjoy myself better or more if I have better fitness.
Yeah, that's your motivation, right? Like you have to find the why to go through. I think for all of us, we train for different things. And I've learned about myself just through the pandemic and everything else this year. I've learned that I don't necessarily need an event to motivate me. And there's something more that I enjoy about the whole experience of progress, I guess, that I get. And maybe that it's measurable and it's repeatable and it's something that I know is achievable. All of that stuff is motivating within the process itself, but it's super important to find your why. And I'm probably similar to you in the regard that I do need to get out and just ride. And I love that feeling of going out and mountain biking on awesome trails, you know, and yeah. So, and I know this sounds like a plug, but that's really one of the reasons why I love outside workouts too, because I can still get in my work and then I get in my intervals and then I do awesome descending as well. So it's pretty great. Megan, thank you so much for coming on and sharing all this. Hopefully this has given folks some tips about things that they can apply to all sorts of racing that they're doing, whether it's really long stuff, whether it's riding across a continent or whether it's something that's just longer than your normal event or the same distance, whatever it is. I've learned a ton on the logistics side of things and planning things out. It's been awesome. And I'm excited to see whatever you do in the future with this stuff. It'll be exciting. So can people find you on Instagram or anything else like that to be able to follow you, or should they just head to the forum?
Yeah, I'm on Instagram as it's my full name, Megan Hakkinen. And I have a website. That's again, my full name, Megan Hakkinen. And, I think I'm Megan Hakkinen on the forum and everything as well. So
cool. Awesome.
It's simple and streamlined.
That's the way to do it. So that you can go into the forum, search for Megan's name. That's M-E-A-G-H-A-N, Megan. And Hakkinen is the last name, which I don't even need to spell this because you're seeing it in the title right now anyway. So you can search that name on the forum, find this, find links to anything, ask any further questions that you have for Megan as well. Thanks a bunch, Megan, and we'll stay in touch.
Awesome. Thanks for having me.
Thanks.